Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige podcast. This time we're talking about the 2005 Western romance Brokeback Mountain. It's directed by one Ang Lee, who I've enjoyed some of his work, in particular Life of Pi, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Screenplay by Larry McMurtry and Diana Ossana, who based that on the short story Brokeback Mountain by Annie Prolix. It stars the late, great Heath Ledger. You've seen him as the Joker. You've seen him as First Knight. We just did a podcast on both of those. Jake Gyllenhaal, he of Nightcrawler, Donnie Darko, and Southpaw fame. Anne Hathaway, who also Batman alum, played Catwoman, Devil Wears Prada. We've done a few podcasts with her in it as well. And Michelle Williams, who you might recognize from Synecdoche, New York, Shutter Island, Manchester by the Sea. Honestly, has a bunch of great cameos and supporting stars. Randy Quaid is in this movie. It's the first time I've ever taken him seriously as an actor.
Yep.
The crazy man from Independence Day, National Lampoon's Vacation series. Linda Cardellini,
mm-hmm.
From Freaks and Geeks, Mad Men. Anna Faris from Lost in Translation, Scary Movies. Smiley Face. David Harbour. Comes out of nowhere, barreling in for a scene, right? Who we know is Sheriff Hopper and Stranger Things. Kate Mara is in this movie. The only thing I've seen a Bald Move related is House of Cards. And music by Gustavo Santaolalla. Oh, wow. I just realized I didn't have a handle on his last name. Santaolalla. He is the, if you've heard of his name, it's because he also is the composer for the soundtrack for both Last of Us video games.
And or because he won an Oscar for this. Yeah. Well, one of those two.
Sure. But like as soon as I saw that connection, I'm like, oh, of course, knowing the soundtrack of this movie.
Yeah.
I have been looking forward to seeing this film for a long while. This was like, universally praised, won a shit ton of Oscars. Made a decent amount of money too for kind of an art house film. What did you think of this movie, Jim?
This movie made a shitload of money. Like calling a 10x on your budget, more than 10x. This cost $14 million and made $178 million. That's really good. Yeah, like you, I was familiar with the reputation of this movie as being, one of extreme quality, and that it was very moving. And all that stuff. And I kind of went into this movie with those expectations, expecting to be immediately gripped by the story of these two men who fall in love and to be sort of like taken away by the story. And I kind of was, but kind of not. I guess maybe my expectations were a little bit too high. And I expected a little bit the movie to show a little bit more of the passion in like its actual passionate form, as opposed to sort of, hinting around the edges at it, because the movie does a lot of that.
It was tasteful.
I don't even mean like gay sex. That's not what I'm talking about when I say passion. I mean like the feelings that these people had for each other. Like you get drips and drabs of it, I think, throughout the movie, right? Like, because there'll be entire chunks of the movie where they're going about their lives and just doing the things that cowboys do, raising families outside of like their relationship, that stuff. I guess I didn't see that part of the movie coming, and it didn't quite like suck me in the way I expected it to, even though I could recognize, holy shit, the acting in this movie is incredible. Heath Ledger is so good. Mm-hmm. Jake Gyllenhaal, as credited as the supporting actor here, which I think is a little strange because I see them both as leads.
Yeah.
But I recognized that it was a really good movie. It just wasn't bringing me in emotionally as much as I kind of expected it to by reputation.
I expected it to be beautiful because that's kind of Ang Lee's movies. Mm-hmm. And I expected it to be kind of like very romantic in the sense of like the Anne of Green Gables, like just heightened emotions, because that's usually what you get out of, an Ang Lee film. I've liked Ang Lee for a long while. Drove like 4.5 hours to go see Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon when it was in limited release. I don't know. Did it ever get a wide release? I think it did. But like a lot of times I admire Ang Lee films more than I actually kind of like or love them, with a couple exceptions, like Life of Pi. I really like that movie. And this movie, I think, is my new favorite Ang Lee film.
Oh yeah, easily,
because
for me,
while it's beautiful and it's extremely well acted, and we're going to talk about that too, I did get kind of caught up in it, and this Heath Ledger kind of living his life as a ghost because of the societal expectations and his own pressures that he puts on himself and his ideas of what he has to conform and you know, like also very real danger about like living this lifestyle openly. I related a lot to that. And I remember like when this movie came out, I was still like, you know, a practicing Jehovah's Witness. I'd kind of like gotten disillusioned with the beliefs, but I was kind of in like, well, this isn't a bad way to live and all my friends and family are in here, so I'll just like keep going to the meetings and kind of pretend, and how hard will that be, right? Like a closeted witness. So like this is kind of like the cautionary tale of the like road less taken or the road not taken. Like, what if I had gone down that? And I can really, you know, empathize with Heath Ledger. Like, there's that scene where he breaks down and says, I'm nobody and I'm nowhere. I'm just like stuck in this liminal space where I can't ever get out of it because I can't embrace who I want to be. But I also, because I have tasted that, I can't go back to who I was.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there was a lot of passion. And like I said, I guess I was expecting, because the way people were, you know, I was in a deeply, maybe it's, I just got this because I was in a deeply fundamental conservative religion, but like people were fucking scandalized by this movie. Like, look at the smut they're putting out. So I was expecting, you know, some pretty hot gay sex. And it was, like I said, tasteful, which, I don't mind. I've seen hot gay sex and I've seen tastefully done. It doesn't matter either way to me. I guess I was surprised by the reputation, but that I think it's like kind of shows how far society's come. Like, why do we really care about all this? But also like how close to, like, I was reading Roger Ebert's review, you know, great Roger Ebert, who brought it around to like Matthew. Is it Matthew Shepard, who's the kid that got killed in Nebraska in like 94, 95? Like, that movie, this movie is as close to that day as we are to Brokeback Mountain.
True. Yeah.
So like things have really changed a lot, but I really, really like this movie. It's beautiful. Like, just little things, like in the opening scenes, like Heath Ledger gets out and you see Brokeback for the first time, and there's like this real tall grass, and you know, it's, you only see this on the prairie, like literally you can see that you can see that the ocean is an atmosphere of air because of the way it moves through these tall grasses and stuff. And just the beautiful scenery, like the first 40 minutes is indistinguishable from like the type of YouTube that I like watching, which is essentially a couple dudes going out and living in the woods. And, you know, like traditionally on YouTube, they don't start having sex. But I was just like, you know,
in the terms of service. Sure.
Yeah. They don't really like the hardcore sex of the homo or heterosexual variety. But I liked that. Like, it was a lot of just like, man, I'm jealous of these guys. Like, you know, yeah, I can see. And maybe we can have a discussion about the relative merits of an outdoor life versus. But like, sometimes I do feel like, I don't know, I wasn't meant to be inside all day fucking long.
And maybe
I
wasn't, be a mountain man. It's fine.
Maybe I wasn't supposed to be out in the mountains all day either. But like, there is something to that, like simplicity of, you know, you got your camp chores, you got to watch these animals. And this was a kind of an exploitative, you know, abusive workplace relationship. This guy's mistreating these guys. He's nickel and diming them. They don't got good food. They don't got good accommodation. They're there illegally. But like,
yeah, I have questions about that, but
yeah, if you did that thing where like, you know, Jake was talking about the whole movie about, you know, finding some place that they could just do this like calf and cow operation, like, God damn, how could you beat that?
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought a lot about like, you know, towards the end of the movie, I was thinking a lot about like the idea of compulsory heterosexuality, the fact that like how many people miss out on like their own lives because they don't even consider options that they could have taken. And
yeah, and, for sure. Like the middle of this movie kind of drags a little bit when they're just so separated and they see like each other once a year or something. Maybe I'm trying to like figure out the time frames in this movie. But like the bookends of this movie, the first part of it is amazing. The end of it, I think, is amazing. Can't say enough good about Heath Ledger's acting in this movie. And not to downplay Jake Gyllenhaal, he's also excellent, but you know, Heath Ledger is the standout here. The whole thing, like from, I guess basically when they get back together to the end of the movie, that's all really, really good.
The second act, or like the middle stretch, that I feel like you maybe were a little listless to. I still maintain my interest, and I was aware of what was happening, like, my God, they're peeling years of time off.
Yeah.
And still finding a thread of this relationship, and like knowing, because that's the thing, I've done a little bit of amateur storytelling dabbling, and a lot I get stuck in these things, like, well, mm-hmm. I kind of got this cool idea for a story, but like, Jesus Christ, how do you tell a story that spans 25 years and you check in with guys' lives every 3 or 4, and you can tell by the kids and the clothes and the tent styles, like the time has elapsed, but how do you keep that thread? And I just thought that the way this movie does it is ingenious, because I instantly, like, it's not like you get a fade to black 3 years later, fade mm-hmm. to white. It's just like a cut, and you just understand that, like, this guy's married now, and now he's got two babies, and now they look like they're in school. And it just kind of flows effortlessly.
Yeah, it kept me a little bit detached from, like, the passion, like I said. If this, you know, relationship was super passionate, it seems like that middle part is the part where I just sort of go, you know, I don't know. I'm not sure how you tell that story in a more visceral way, to where I'm feeling the passion moment to moment, because it is a story that spans a long time and necessarily has to be at a remove from that passion.
Well, it's like when Jake is gone, and like it's they haven't seen each other for 4 years, I think, you know, mm-hmm. and they come back and they hug, but then instantly Heath like pulls him into the alley and they start making out. Like, I think that's what sells it. And I was like, because I was like, well, wondering if there will be some awkward kind of like, you know, dancing around, if this was like a one time thing, or, you know, like, how much have they been pining for each other? And then when they just kind of go for it, I was kind of like, I got this kind of like elation, but then they add the other wrinkle of Michelle Williams seeing the whole thing. Yeah. And like that kind of becoming like that. That's the thing. It's like he always found a way to, like, even when the scene is just kind of like on a low boil or a simmer, when the movie, like, there's like things that kind of like made me gasp, like that, for example.
Yeah. And those moments are extremely well inserted into the movie. Like, you need, there's a moment like when they part ways for the first time that, you know, Heath Ledger kind of takes himself off to the side because it's so emotionally torturous for him. Mm-hmm. You need that moment to sell any of the rest of the movie. And this movie is extremely well constructed in that regard. Like, every time you need to see and understand something about these characters, the movie is there to hold your hand through that. Mm. And like, say, yeah, this is, you might not see it on the surface, but that's because everybody in this movie is trying to hide that shit. Right.
It also relies on, frankly, star power. Like, they don't have any time to tell the story of how Jake and Anne Hathaway get together. But what they do have time for Anne Hathaway to ride by looking like $1 million in a sequin outfit and wink at the camera. And you're like,
yeah,
nobody's that gay. her dad's rich, and like,
there certainly are people. I mean, but I take,
well,
no,
yeah,
meaning,
I know, like, yeah. I'm making an Archer joke, but like,
right,
yeah, there's like, that's, you can see like why he would be like, fuck it, I'll try it. And the same way with Jake, like when you see his home life, and how much he loves his girls, and Michelle Williams is kind of a real sweetheart trying to make things work at this kind of, like, you know, this bleak living conditions and subsistence ranching, farming. I don't know. They rely on the fact that everyone is on at the top of their game and can, within a second, you get what they're about. And it's all about the costuming, it's all about the hair and makeup, and it's all about the actor's performance. And Heath, like you said, like, yeah, we're propping him up because, you know, he's not around anymore, and he's still like this big thing of potential. And we just got done gushing about Jake and the Southpaw podcast, which will be coming out here pretty soon too. But like Heath, like I went from, like, when he first started talking, I'm like, I don't know about this accent, this might be distracting. 3 minutes later, I completely forgotten about that. And by the time the movie ends, he's such a real fucking character that I almost forget that it's Heath Ledger.
It's a transformative performance from him. And he does that in every role I've seen him in, you know, with the exception of 10 things I hate about you, or whatever it's called.
Yeah. Or like First Night, he's kind of like, I don't know, but not First Night, I'm sorry.
Knight's Tale.
Knight's Tale. But yeah, he really swung for defenses, and he convincingly plays like this 19-year-old guy who's never been in love, or maybe been too scared by his father to be in love. And two, he plays this kind of like broken down, 50-year-old man,
thereabouts.
Like I said, that's essentially condemned to live as a ghost in his own fucking life now. And I guess
I don't want to like sell the movie, the storytelling too short, because it's an excellently constructed script. Like I said, I think there's a moment toward the end that really emphasizes how much this is about, how much this is about the love that Jack has for Ennis, as opposed to just like Jack being gay and going for any dude, right? Because David Harbour, I think, in the end of this movie makes a pass at him.
Yeah.
And he just doesn't say anything. He doesn't respond to it, right? Because that's not who he loves. So I think the movie does a really good job of telling you, like, with just the story that this is a love affair that these two guys have, as opposed to just like a lot of other movies that would just be like, huh, they're gay, so they'll go for anybody, right, of the same sex. Like,
I thought that Ebert did a really good job of calling that out in the review. He says, you know, people are calling this a gay cowboy film, which is like a cruel, like, joke, like a trivialization of this movie.
Yeah,
but that's what his reputation was.
So much more,
100%.
Yeah.
And I think that's like, I do wonder though, like sometimes like how movies like this do shape the public perception, because it's very hard to watch this movie and think that they come away with the viewpoint anything else than like the only crime that's committed here is the fact that these men were made to hide the truth about themselves, to each other, to society, and all the pain to themselves and their loved ones that caused that deception.
And the murders. The murders are crimes, but
right. Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like whether that's something to talk about. Like the final scene with Heath Ledger and finding the fate of his lover. Like, did that really happen? Was this him transposing?
Yeah.
You know,
all good questions.
Yeah. That we can get to. But that's like I'm thinking, like, you know, like how much do you got to. I mean, but that's the other thing. It's like also the people that probably need to see a movie like this don't seek it out. But like, how do you go through this journey and think about like that the again, there's nothing wrong with what these guys did, except for they were born in a time and place where this just wasn't allowed, like not even to consider it.
Yeah.
That's sad. That's sad. Like, think about how much human misery has been caused by just that.
Mm-hmm.
And how much more, you know, it's like, you know, if to the extent you want to say America is better, you know, there's a whole rest of the world out there. We still got things to work on our own.
Oh yeah.
But I really like the movie. The performances, like we said, and it's not just the voice work he does, like there's something,
it's his physicality.
Like he just like really embodies that Marlboro man, where it's like just stoicism and no reaction. Like he's got very like, I think Tom Hanks has more dialogue in fucking
Castaway
than Heath Ledger does in the first 40 minutes of this film. They make it a point to point that out.
Yeah.
And he just does so much by just pulling so far back into himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the times where that facade breaks is like, there's a couple points in this movie where like, does he really care that much one way or another? Or is Jake, cause like you always tell Jake's like got his heart on his sleeve.
Yeah.
And like, is this like easy for him? Is it just about the sex? Is it just, but like when that dam finally breaks, it's really powerful, all the more powerful because it's been held up for the whole fucking movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it only does it like twice, like, and it's interesting as a movie constructs it to where Jake never sees him break down about himself. It's always like, you know, they have this fist, you know, and he's driving away. And he's like, well, I guess we'll see you when I see you. And then as soon as he gets out of sight, he just has like a fucking massive panic attack, wave of sickness of perhaps the love of his life getting away. And it happens again to kind of kick off the last act of the movie. And it's, I mean, shit, this movie got rained Oscars on for a goddamn reason.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the awards it did win?
Let's do it.
Best director for Ang Lee. He won it. Also best adapted screenplay and best original score. And I couldn't help but notice the score. Maybe we can talk about that a little here and then we can go on to what it didn't win. I very much felt like it has a consistent tone throughout the entire movie, which is romantic wilderness music is the best way I can describe it. It's like a lot of like not jangly. It's not jangly country guitars like you think. It's more like serene country style guitarist guitarisms.
It's something you'd hear a guy noodling on the trail.
Yeah, and it's got a serene and beautiful quality to it, and it kind of maintains that throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of a time when it doesn't, when it goes like darker or it goes.
I think it does. There's definitely a couple notes of like triumph or like playfulness in the first bit of their relationship. And then there was I did think that there was a lot of melancholy, like especially the scene where he goes back to visit his parents and like he's going through it. The part where he grabs, finds out that like that shirt he lost on the mountain all those years ago is something that that Twitch is kept for himself. Like that, I thought that's where the cut the because I was kind of like, yeah, this soundtrack is fine, it's doing okay, but like when it hit that note, I'm like, yeah, I can't imagine this movie sounding like anything else, and all of this has worked up to this.
Yeah, for sure, it's great music, and they use some contemporary music as well. I think like Sweet Melissa, the Allman Brothers is in there.
Yeah, what was that once sad country love song that Jake Gyllenhaal was listening to as he was driving away from, because you know Heath Ledger got a divorce and he's thinking, oh, we can start living our lives the way we want him to, and he's like, I still got these girls and I still got to work and all, and he sends them packing, and he's listening to some Patsy Cline, Eternal Love kind of that really matched the mood and something like I could say, like, you know, what do they call that? The exogenic? What's the where it's coming?
Diegetic?
Diegetic. Where yeah. The music's coming from a visible place in the radio. And like, you just see like one of those things where it's like, everyone's had that experience where you just got your heart broke and you turn on the radio and they're playing the saddest fucking song and it just fucking kicks your ass. Like I felt like that's where those pieces were used. And it was really effective.
Mm-hmm. The shame, I guess, of the awards is that as good as Heath Ledger was, he couldn't outdo Philip Seymour Hoffman in Capote.
That's pretty. I mean, man, I've seen Capote. We did a podcast on it, and I remember being very impressed at like what a huge transformation Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's got so much range. He can be a lady killer in plausible like womanizer in the Talented Mr. Ripley, and he can be Truman Capote. Mm-hmm. That's tough. That's splitting some pretty fucking fine hairs there.
It really is, man. I like what he talked about, that and the tragedy of Heath Ledger dying at that time is just like probably the most tragic Hollywood death in my generation.
But then you got Philip Seymour Hoffman there too. Like his career not cut as short, but like we got robbed of old man's, if nothing else, old man Philip Seymour Hoffman. Do you know what the kind of crazy shit he would have gotten up to in his like his 50s, 60s, and 70s?
Yeah, for sure.
At least we got like a prime of his.
Ledger, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's sad. What I can only describe as like a play to get both of these guys Oscars, they label Jake Gyllenhaal as a best supporting actor.
Oh, I want to talk about this because I think that makes a lot of sense. This POV is entirely from Heath Ledger, and he's got to have two times the screen time that Jake does, I think.
Yeah. He's definitely like, if you have to pick a lead, Ennis is the lead. Heath Ledger is the lead. But yeah, he lost to George Clooney and Syriana.
Wow. Yeah, that seems like a nothing burger.
Yeah, right.
Syriana, yeah, I'll just she hear people still talk about that performance in hushed tones.
They don't. Best supporting actress was Michelle Williams. She got nominated, but she lost to Rachel Weisz in The Constant Gardener. I saw that movie. Yeah, sure. She certainly has a lot more screen time in that movie.
That's the thing. Like there's the performance was strong, but like there's nothing. None of these women are in this movie for any fucking longer than they have to be. Absolutely have to be to serve to hit their marks and deliver the emotional payload. And that's appropriate because it's not their story.
I agree.
It's not their love story. But like, yeah, I think if she had another 10 minutes of screen time, that would have been a tougher call.
And the seventh and final nomination here was Best Cinematography, which was actually taken by it. Memoirs of a Geisha.
Huh. I mean, that's a beautiful film in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
So I guess, yeah, that's these are both gorgeous films.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to be more impressed by like the great outdoors and how you frame it and things like that. And, you know, like, and there's also a lot of set design, like Jake's mom and dad's house, like that white, like everything just fucking whitewashed. Like that was a really cool visual look, and the way they shoot things and angles they get and like waiting for the right foreboding, you know, storm front to roll in over the mountains. Like I prefer that, but like, yeah, that's not a travesty, I guess.
No, I haven't seen the movie, but its reputation precedes.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
I will say this. I didn't know anything about this movie other than it was like a quote unquote gay. And I guess I was, I was expecting that to be kind of like a coming of age film. And I thought that we were going to stay like on that Endless Summer and Brokeback for.
Yes.
A much larger chunk of the movie than we ended up. Like,
for sure.
I was kind of like Heath Ledger when I found out the thing was being cut short. I was like, what the fuck? I was borderline outraged. I was dismayed. I was disappointed. I like it. There's like two almost, you know, there's an hour and 45 minutes of this movie left. What's going on? There is, I guess that makes it a little bit more poignant. The fact that like this love affair was all based on something that happened when they're so young and was so short. But yet so real that they both held on to it for 4 years of various marriages and careers and not seeing each other, not sending a single letter, not a phone call.
Yeah, that romantic. Sounds like late teens or early 20s. Sure. I remember that time. Certainly.
I also thought that was, it was going to be more of a seduction. That's the other thing that surprised me, that like, that there would be kind of like some passes and some like, you know, him and hawing about it. But like when that scene happened, like when, you know, it's because I, you know, it got cold and he's got too drunk and he's going to have to sit in the tent. I'm like, okay, this is how things are going to start. But like, it just escalated really quickly. And then, you know, became kind of like you said, this torrid love affair. Do you think that they were sent home a month early because of the storms or because of whatever the guy, the boss, and Randy Quaid, like being skeeved out by their relationship?
I think it's the latter. I do. And I'm not sure that they even lost as many sheep as he you know, that the sheep loss was as bad as he claimed it was.
It didn't seem like, yeah, especially the year before had 25% sheep loss or whatever.
He just seemed like he was uncomfortable with the idea of two gay men up on his mountain tending to his sheep.
Yeah, because like his uncle, he went up there, found for the first time, and then he comes back and it's like, I don't think they lost any more than like the one sheep, because I think they would have showed it if there was more. And maybe like came away with some bonus Chilean sheep, but this guy's making it like, oh, these are unacceptable counts, blah, blah, blah. Like, ah, fuck you.
Yeah, I think the count would have been unacceptable had they not lost any sheep at that point, frankly.
Yeah. I think I got the same, because like there was that same energy when Jake came back the next year looking for work.
Yeah.
Where he was like trying to make it like all about dollars and cents and figures. And then finally he's like, nah, it's not going to have any Jolly Ranchers on my mountain.
He used a term. Stemming the rose. I didn't know if I had never heard this term for getting it on before.
Is it particular to gay sex, or
I don't know. I imagine it apply to either sex, I would think. But I don't know. I found that kind of funny, you know, in the horrible way that scene was going.
Yeah, it's like it was a well constructed phrase. It reminded me of like something that they'd say on Tombstone, only, you know, horribly homophobic.
Right.
I also like I just really, again, I want to come back to the fact that like how much I enjoyed the first bit of this movie where the guys are just chopping wood and they're doing camp, because like, I mean, we had a little bit of a vigorous discussion about which of the lifestyles we prefer, because like I had on my notes is like, I cannot believe we traded this in for an office at some point in our, you know, and I guess like cavemen probably like, I can't believe you traded this in for like fucking agriculture. But like. The fact that you've got like, yeah, just like the simplicity of it, like, you know, you got to split wood and cook wood. You got to split wood, cook food, make sure you have shelter, and then make sure the sheep are doing OK. And that's your job, man. No spreadsheets, no TPS reports, no time cards. You get your shit done. You can carve a horse. You can fuck your buddy. You can do. There's so much bonus, time. I was really envious of that kind of the freedom of that lifestyle and the wholesomeness of like, you know, working with their hands, with the land, seeing return for it. You know, the sheep are getting bigger. They're having babies, all that stuff. Like, that seems like it's really rewarding.
On the flip side, no air conditioning, no heating, no indoor plumbing, bugs constantly up your ass.
In the mountains, I don't know about that. I feel like it doesn't get buggy up there. That's the saving grace.
Bears always up your ass.
Bears up the ass is a bad.
I
don't know,
predators
scene.
Like I feel like the trade off has been totally warranted, and I would not trade the office life that I have for an outdoor life, because I can go get the outdoors if I want it.
Yeah,
you know, that's a luxury I have. Whereas trying to get the office when you don't have it is tough.
3 or 4 months on a mountain just watching sheep sounds like sounds pretty good, especially if you can like provide for a family off that time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that's like is the, like, as I said, because the constant bean diet would get to me, but I thought that was more of you know, Randy Quaid being a cheap bastard that's too cheap to provide the spuds and powdered milk, and it's just beans than it was like that's just inherent to the job, because it just seemed like this guy is an incredibly cheap guy.
If you could give me some elk meat and a few tortillas, I think I'd be in good shape with the beans, constant beans.
Yeah, the elk look good.
Okay, can you answer a question? I don't know anything about sheep herding. I know nothing about fucking state parks or regulations or hunting seasons or any of that stuff, because I work in an office and I've never had to learn it. Why is what they were doing illegal? Because the movie makes a point to like kind of tell you, hey, you shouldn't be here with these sheep. And if you get caught, you know, keeping these sheep in this pasture up here, is it just because it's not his land?
I think it's like this. Let's say I barely know any of this stuff, but like there's this Bureau of Land Management that allows like big sections of what the Western states to be used as essentially, you know, pasture for cattle, sheep, etc.
Okay.
But you might not be able to camp there overnight or build a fire set. Like, it's like a different kind of thing. You're supposed to like just let your cows there and but you're not supposed to like live there. I think it's like one of those deals where it's like, you know, you can run your animals, but this guy's the place he's running has a coyote problem, but you're not allowed to camp there. So
how do they expect you to protect your animals then?
I don't know. Like, I don't. That's what I'm saying. Like, I know there's all kinds of disputes about water rights and pasture rights and things like that. Like, you know, like it's illegal to shoot a wolf, but what do you do? You know, a gray wolf in certain places, but what do you do if the gray wolf is fucking killing your sheep? Like, I think there's a reason why a lot of rural types hate the government, because they're almost always trying to fuck with their livelihood. Sometimes there's good reasons for that. Sometimes there's stupid, right, shitty reasons for that. So, like, I think that that's like, you know, there's a lot of that in the movie, like how hard it is to be kind of like this middle class in certain areas of the country, where it's like there are people who feel that pinch between like their costs and their taxes and the government squeezing them. And it feels like you can't get ahead, you know. Yeah. But they just assume their problems are the same people as the, you know, like the billionaires on Wall Street. And they, yeah, anyway. But I thought that was, there's some interesting little comments about that too, about and then it's also interesting in conjunction with, like, Jake is the one bitching about that, and he's talking to someone who's like truly poor, yeah, like just at the poverty line.
He's got no perspective.
Yeah. Like, that's like, and that's the thing. It's like, a lot of times you can shut the fuck those people the fuck up when they start talking about it. It's like, dude, look at the three fucking dually trucks you got, your 45-foot RV, you've got six horses, a six bed, like, shut the fuck up about barely making it, you know.
They do a great job just painting that picture with wardrobe. Like, you can see Heath Ledger's clothes haven't gotten much better, right, over the course of
the
20 years or whatever, whereas Jake Gyllenhaal shows up wearing brand new hat, there's not a speck of dirt on it, brand new coat, like, his truck is pristine. And that fucking truck that Heath Ledger is driving,
oh my god,
they just don't make them like these. They don't make trucks like these anymore that would withstand the kind of abuse that he's putting on that truck and still keep running for
20 fucking years.
Yeah.
No, it's funny because you see, like, Heath Ledger's living in his, like, bombed out old trailer. And then there's a couple times where we see that Jake Gyllenhaal is essentially living in the Plains, Texas 1975 version of the Henry Hill house from Goodfellas.
Sure.
It's the exact same level of taste and sophistication. It's just Central Plains, Texas instead of, you know, fucking crime syndicate New Jersey. But oh my god, that house. Can we talk about that a little bit? Like, the purple velvet chairs, the like cow skulls hung up on this, like, what, it was crazy how much it all was.
Yeah. Is this the same house that they have Thanksgiving dinner in? Because that was one of the standout scenes to me, is the Thanksgiving dinner where Jack stands up to his father-in-law.
Yeah, where his dad tries to, you know, emasculate him in his own home, and he stands like, nope, this is my wife, my kid, my house, you're my guest, shut the fuck up, sit down, I'm gonna carve the damn turkey.
Yeah.
That was a great scene.
It is. Yeah, and all I can remember is, like, the TV. There's like, this sunken area, like you would think of a Mad Men-style loft in New York, right?
Mm-hmm.
They get the sunken viewing area, and this TV built sort of into a console, and, yeah, it's gaudy.
One thing about other standout scenes, because that's something I kind of associate Ang Lee, is, like, really interesting camera takes and, like, really beautiful kind of vacative shots. Does any stand out in your mind? Because there's one in particular I want to talk about.
The one where Ennis tells Jack that he's not going to be able to come back and see him for a while, and they're it's kind of like at the end of their stay with each other, and they're just by this river, and you can see all the mountains in the background. Yeah, that was one of them.
I like the one where Heath Ledger whips the biker's ass at the 4th of July, and, like, and you know, he's, like, framed by, like, the fireworks go off the second the violence begins, and, like, it's like this forced perspective, but it makes Heath Ledger look like a fucking colossus, like Dr. Manhattan striding over the battlefield of Vietnam or something.
It's almost comical. It's like so Like, it's pressing the issue so much that it's almost funny to me. Yeah, I almost laughed when I saw it.
Because it was one of those gasps where I'm just, I can't, like, this is, like, it is one of those things where it made me, the same way, like, Michelle Williams just casually opened the door and her reaction to seeing Jake and Heath going at it. Like, I just thought it was just incredible.
Yeah. But there are beautiful shots of nature all over this movie.
What do you think about the scene where, you know, Heath Ledger gets a postcard? Because that's one of these guys communicate through postcards, set up all their fishing trips and so forth. He gets that one that's returned because he's deceased, and he calls Anne Hathaway, and she kind of tells him matter of factly that he had a flat. He's airing it up. The tire exploded, this rim. And Heath Ledger hears this as, you know, he was victim of a homophobic lynch mob.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that there's a way that you can conclusively answer the question of this, but do you have in your mind, like, which version of the reality is correct and which one is not?
Yeah. I take what Ennis imagines to be the truth. I think he was, you know, because the whole movie is building up to the blowback that they're going to get for Brokeback. he's saying, like, you can't go around doing this stuff. I've seen people get killed. Like, my father showed me this body when I was 9. This guy did the exact same thing. And yeah, I think the movie is building to that reveal where he was not, you know, quote unquote, careful enough. He was going over to Mexico all the time. He, like, started making passes at other people in bars and getting involved there, maybe.
That's sloppy.
Yeah, he just got sloppy with it, and somebody found out.
Got sloppy through your love,
right?
The one thing that I took it through the lens of that quote about a coward dies a thousand deaths, a brave man dies but one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that this is something that Heath Ledger has been, you know, rightfully so. He got dragged out as, like, what was it, 7-year-old? He said, and like, look at this, and what we did, and maybe even suspecting that his dad did that. You know, just graphic, like, that you've got to hate the way you are, boy. That, like, I thought maybe they're trying to say, because that was something that, you know, over the years, over 20, 25 years, Jake's begging him to, like, please, can we take the chance now? And he's like, you don't know. And what happens if, and the fact that, like, he could just die from some random accident. And that's nothing that the Heath Ledger never even considered, that, like, the few precious moments he has, like, what if those don't keep going, you know? Or the fact that, like, he did finally get beat to death and they've been denying themselves this thing that would make themselves so happy, and it ended up happening anyway.
Yeah.
I'm not sure which of those is the valid one, but both of them are kind of kicking around in my mind.
Yeah, it could go either way. I think it's the way that Anne Hathaway describes his death to me that kind of sells.
Dude, yeah.
That she was. She's detached from the story she's telling. She's almost reciting a rehearsed speech to him, right? There's no emotion that she's giving off here. And you would think that there would be if she didn't, like, find out at some point that what was going on between them. And when she realizes, you know, it's Ennis and the guy he went fishing with and all that stuff, I think she's doing something with her performance that makes me think that what he's imagining actually did happen.
I got two things to ask about the women in this movie. Anne Hathaway, you mentioned her performance and kind of like it being a little cagey. Do you think that she knew that Ennis and was it Jim? Jim Twist is his name?
Jack
Twist. Do you think that she knew that they were doing this on it, or was she putting this together in real time? Because I thought there was some kind of awareness and like her being more interested in the phone conversation and a little bit more judgy at a certain point in it. And so, like, I was wondering if, you know, again, because I was thinking that his mental thing was like just his worst fears coming to truth.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like, I don't know, because, like, maybe I kind of interpreted her as her doing the mental math and not having been privy to stuff like Michelle Williams, that she was just now putting together, like, everything, the circumstances about what did you see that or feel that or what?
The vibe I got, and this is all headcanon stuff, right? Is that like when Jack was discovered, because he, you know, got sloppy, was going to Mexico, whatever he was doing over there. He got discovered, he got killed. And then that rumor had to spread, right? The knowledge of, you know, who Jack really was probably spread throughout the town. She probably found out post posthumously that he was involved in that.
Maybe.
And then like, so that would be like connecting the dots, right? Like she might not have known who he was involved with, but it now was starting to all click when Innes calls her. Yeah. I could totally see that being what happened.
Because it's completely asymmetrical. Like they point out in the movie that like Jake always went up to see him in Oklahoma. So like she never got to see them the way that Michelle Williams did. Yeah. And I guess that's the other question I had is like, why did Michelle Williams pull that out of Heath? Like they'd already been, she'd known the whole time. They'd already been divorced. She knew with a mortal certainty what was going on. Mm-hmm. They seemed like they had, you know, she had remarried. The kids were happy. Heath was happy. He's not like, you have to worry that he's going to go and have another gay cowboy relationship and scandalize the family. Didn't seem like he was interested in that. In fact, I don't think he has it within himself to start. Like, I don't think he's got like what Jake had where he could go make passes at people in public.
Yeah.
Why did she do it?
I don't really know.
She just needs to hear that I wasn't crazy and that this actually, but like, I feel like, I don't know.
Yeah,
like
and it's been eating at her for a long time. I can understand why she did it. I don't know why she chose that moment to do it.
Do you think his daughters knew? Because I felt like, there was a little bit with the Mara Rooney performance where like she kind of hinted around that maybe.
Yeah, with Alma Jr.
Yeah.
Maybe I'd have to see it again to try and figure out where
that's the thing. And it's tough because again, like, I can't say enough how this is aggressively the story of Jake and Heath Ledger. It's the movie doesn't really concern itself with anybody else other than like, if they introduced a daughter or a woman or something else, it's always in the, how the men feel about their relationship with each other.
I think it's pretty subtly constructed. I don't think it's like, you know, I think we were both surprised by the fact that we didn't spend more time on Brokeback Mountain early in the movie and seeing that relationship develop for longer. But then it gets way more subtle toward the end with like who knows what and who's hiding things and who are they hiding them from? And, you know, what are they feeling about these relationships in any given moment? It gets very subtle and very complicated toward the end. As it should, right? As this relationship would.
Yeah, I remember out of context, did you remember the line, "I wish I could quit you"? Like that became a meme back in 2005. And I remember like, kind of like, Jesus, that seems like such a cheesy fucking line. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, there's like, you know, as Ted Lasso pointed out in the last week's episode, there's no shortage of cheesy lines in heterosexual romance movies. But honestly, when I saw this in its full fucking context of like of Heath like debating about quitting his job and have to put food on his table and like being like, I know I can't quit, like his response, like seeing it was, it's not ridiculous at all.
Yeah,
it was at that point in the movie, like you're completely gripped up in emotions of it. And him like, you know, I wish it was as simple, like, you know, I wish quitting you is as simple as like quitting a ranch job at the end of a summer or something.
Right.
Because God, if I knew how to do it, I would. And then that opened up Heath, because up to the time, like again, I was thinking like, is this like a one-sided love affair? Mm-hmm. You know, is this like a guy saying like, oh sure, I'll leave my wife, baby, it's just, but he's never going to. But him opening up like that, how this has completely tore his life open, that he was, you know, it completely turned his life upside down and he doesn't have a way to get to move on. God, it's so tragic.
There's a line earlier in the movie that Innes tells Jack, he says, if you can't fix it, you got to stand it. And that movie stuck, or that line stuck with me throughout this movie, because that's really the crux of it, right? Like, there will be things in your life, and everybody's experienced things like this. You don't have to be a star-crossed gay lover to have experienced this emotion. The idea that there's something that you desperately need in your life, and you're unable to get it for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, you can't fucking move somewhere you want to move or get the job you want or be with the person you want. It's that has happened to just about everybody. And that's like the main, the biggest thrust of this movie that comes across to me is Jack's feelings in this movie are not unrequited, but unactionable, right? You can't, there's nothing he can do about it, but he also can't live with it. It's like that, that's a hard thing to just stand it, right?
There's no reins on this thing. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Do you think that, like, the concept I've been become aware of, because I've learned so much new shit in the last 15, 16 years from where I lived my life before, but, like, you know, I read a lot of thought that, like, bisexuals have and non-binary folks, asexuals have, and there's this concept of like, compulsory, especially in, like, I guess lesbian circles, compulsory heterosexuality, whether you get in an environment, you get in a culture where, like, you're kind of told that, like, sexual pleasure and desire really isn't something that, like, women kind of do or feel or experience. It's certainly not in the same way of men. And that, like, everyone just pairs off male-female, that it doesn't even occur to some young lesbians that, like, oh, God, I actually do like girls.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't like men sexually because I guess, you know, why would I? My mom didn't like my dad sexually, and she only did, you know, had sex for purposes of procreation, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that, like, I feel like it must happen a lot with guys too, mm-hmm. though, that, like, you're only in your own head, and, like, you always hear about the temptations of, you know, like you could be tempted into being gay. Mm-hmm. So, like, well, maybe this is something everybody feels, and it's something that they don't even consider. And I think if, like, you know, I don't know, because, like, right now we're in this low nadir for, like, people's communities. Like, between social media and our jobs and the way we've structured our cities and public places, there's just not a lot sky high loneliness is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
People getting into relationships later, moving out later, all this kind of stuff. I wonder if in 50 to 100 years, the idea that you might have, because that's another thing I've heard bisexual people talk about, the fact that they might be sexually interested in someone, but romantically they're straight. Like they're sexually bisexual, but romantically they're straight. Or I've heard other ones say that I can really only fall in love with another man. I'm romantically gay, but I'm sexually bisexual. And I've been thinking about this in my own life a lot. Like, am I straight, or am I only do I just not think that a guy like Jake Gyllenhaal is in my league? If I was 19 years old and Brokeback Mountain, the peak of my life, and I've got this young, strong body, am I super 100% straight, or is this compulsory? I would never even consider forming a sexual relationship with a good buddy of mine or friend of mine.
I don't know how to tell you, but there are less attractive men than Jake Gyllenhaal in the world.
I don't want to fuck him.
Okay. All right.
Maybe I'd be gay if hot guys would be willing to have sex with me, but I'm not. Right. The pool, I could get a fellow bear, but I'm not attracted to guys like me. If I'm attracted to guys, but I've been thinking about that. If so far it hasn't really gotten, I think about I wonder if you like to have sex with Chris Hemsworth. And it doesn't really get past the giggle phase, but also I grew up in a really repressed, what I'm saying is in the future, do you think there will have there'll be stories of teenagers? I can't believe there hasn't been a movie this already where guys are playing Super Mario Brothers Melee on the couch and then find out they just start sucking each other's dicks.
Mm-hmm.
Because why not? Why not? If society loosens up to the point where this is fine to experiment, why wouldn't more men and women turn to their buddies for sexual relationships like that?
Yeah. I don't know. As somebody who thinks he's straight, I can feel a difference, between when I look at a really attractive woman versus a really attractive man. It just doesn't do the same things to me emotionally, chemically, I guess. So I don't know that experimenting with that would do much for me, but I'm sure that I'm not I know I'm not the only position on that. I'm sure there are people who probably do feel sexually different than they feel emotionally.
Yeah. It's just weird because it's how would you know? Because again, with this compulse, if you, I've definitely been in times in my life where there was opportunities open to me that I didn't conceive because I didn't think of myself of asked me 25, would I ever be a podcaster or make a living talking about homosexual cowboy movies on the internet? I'd be get the fuck out of here. There's no way, not me, but look at me now. What if things have broken a bit different? What if things,
Which John Wayne movie are we going to cover next week?
Which butch masculine movie? Yeah, I don't know. Thinking about because you're right. I think that it isn't I'm white knuckling heterosexuality. Oh my God. But it is something
probably
I've been thinking about.
Definitely are, I would think.
Sure. And there's all kinds of degrees. And as I'm saying, it's who knows? Chris Hemsworth, say, I don't know. I keep coming back to him. Someone that's larger, stronger, make me feel small.
I mean, get on Twitter, make at least let him know.
No. I can't take that kind of rejection.
Okay, fair.
Anyway, it's just something that's I've had these conversations with a couple of my male friends, rethinking about because usually I don't think people do how straight or whatever am I? What does that even mean?
I think it's a pretty new phenomenon, certainly outside of my generation, to think of sexuality as a spectrum. Mm-hmm. It used to be you either fuck dudes and you're gay or you fuck women and you're straight. Right.
Yeah.
At this point, I think that has seriously been debunked and we're trying to recontextualize all that. So, yeah, I think it's changing.
Yeah. And I've seen so much crazy stuff happen. One of my favorite cartoonists is a lesbian who ended up marrying a guy from England because that's who she ended up falling in love with.
Okay.
And like, there's, I've seen other things, you know, guys like where they get to a certain age and they realize, I guess I am a little bit, or I'm more bisexual, or, you know, like I'm like, and I can, I guess that's the thing, is I can understand being attracted to hot people, whether that's male or female. And if you're in a situation like you're up on Brokeback Mountain, you're 19 and you're horny, because that's, I guess that's one of the other questions I had, is like, would you call these guys in 2021 gay? Are they mostly gay, but hetero or hetero flexible? Are they bisexual? Because like some of those relationships felt like they were not something they did out of a have to. Like some of the sex that he was having with Michelle Williams didn't seem like it was, or like Jake mentioned that he was kind of like catting around with a female rancher in Texas. Although maybe that's a euphemism. Even this like gay cowboy movie, what I'm getting at is maybe even this quote unquote gay cowboy movie, I thought was a lot more textured.
Yes.
And spectrum-y than I was expecting.
Yeah, I've seen movies where like the leads are just closeted gay men, and that's exactly what they are. And the movie is very different from this. This is much more subtle, like especially that the Jack stuff. Him having women in other towns is a weird thing if he were just a gay man. Because what does he need? He doesn't need cover anymore. He's got it in his wife. So like. Yeah, it is definitely more nuanced than that.
I've heard a lot of people talk about how they're attracted to individuals. It's not about the gender at all. It's like a vibe or a personality type, a certain type of like sexual adventure or whatever. Then the actual configurations that people come with.
Along those lines, anyway, what do you think it is about Ennis that attracted Jack in the first place to him? Because
it seemed like
he doesn't say much. He doesn't do much. He's just a matter of fact, no nonsense kind of guy.
It seems like it's the same thing that gets a lot of people, just the old fashioned lust. Like he gets a load of this tall drink of water. He's like looking at him in the mirror. He's like, it's like suddenly he's like shaving because like, oh, I got to spiff myself up. And there's also like there's a great scene. There's another Ang Lee scene where they're showing Jake conspicuously not looking at Jake Gyllenhaal, like naked, just right. Like, you know, it's like your natural inclination is to try to steal a glance.
I kept expecting the movie to, you know, his eyes dart over just slightly.
It just goes to show, like, even the guy who is relatively open enough to where his dad, it was like an open secret with his parents that he was gay. Right.
Yeah.
Like he's a lot more open and a lot more honest about with himself and maybe others about his life, about who he's attracted to. Even he is buttoned up enough that he's not going to like put himself like, I've just known this guy for a day or two. I'm not going to like, you know, like we're, you know, 2 months in. Like it was in August where they pulled the contract, and it seemed like only a week or two before then that they'd started having a sexual relationship. I just feel like it was like just so cautious. And even like the first time you have sex, that how fucked up is it? You got to deny it. Like, hey, that's just a one time thing. And I just want you to know that I ain't queer. On me either, man. Last far furthest thing. Like that's such a like a stereotype. I've heard that like kind of thing. Like these guys who are aggressively gay, but it's important to them to not be thought of as that way, you know. They're just, I'm not gay, I just get down on my buddy, man, you know.
Yeah, I love that scene where, you know, Heath is undressed in the background. It's a close-up of Jake Gyllenhaal. He's smoking his cigarette, right? The cigarette's just hanging out of his mouth, and it's like a 30-second shot. The restraint that the movie shows there in showing the restraint that Jake Gyllenhaal is displaying as a character is remarkable. Like that's the first shot where I sat up and paid attention to the movie. Because it refused to do the thing that that you kind of expect it to do, but it did it for a hell of a good reason.
Yeah, it made me feel like that feeling you get when you're a guy and you're talking to a woman who has amazing breasts and she's showing them up, but like you can feel like the gravitational pull, but like I'm not gonna do it because I'm not that guy and I don't wanna make this. But like it's like
I'm never aware of where my eyes are really going until that situation
until
occurs.
I'm trying not to look
focused on where my eyes are. Right.
Yeah. Like this is the most interesting cigarette he's ever smoked in his whole fucking life. And I couldn't. Yeah. It's another one of those great scenes. And it works, like you said, precisely because it goes on for so long.
Yeah.
Well, I've pretty much talked everything out. I want to talk about this movie. Do you got anything else that you want to kind of go in on?
Yeah, one other thing. What'd you think of the aging that they did to these characters? Because this takes place, as you mentioned, over like 30 years, 20 plus years.
I thought it worked really well. I thought there was one scene where I could see kind of like the latex.
Which one? Because I agree.
It's the one, I think, towards the end of the movie where he's in the trailer with Mara Rooney.
Kate Mara, yeah.
Jesus, yeah.
Yes, that was the same one that stood out to me.
And it wasn't bad because like they went with more like these guys like have like weather beaten, sun beaten faces than they're really like getting like Tommy Lee Jones craggy. Mm-hmm. So like, it was like always and they did a lot with like hair and makeup and costuming because like a lot of Heath Ledger's aging. But it also like, you know, in terms of like taking my breath away when they smash cut from him as an old man. Well, I guess a 50-year-old man, whatever, back to him being 19. Mm-hmm. And it really showed me how good the aging makeup was because it was so subtle. Like every 5 minutes and a couple years go by. But like I forgot how young they were at the beginning of this film.
Yeah.
So, yeah, other than that, I thought it was pretty good. Okay. It wasn't distracting at all.
Yeah, I totally agree.
All right. Well, I know people have been waiting for 16 years for two mostly straight guys' opinions on this movie, it turns out. I really enjoyed it. I guess, as I said, it's taken over Life of Pi being my new favorite Ang Lee film. If you haven't seen it, it's just a really great love story, a tragic love story.
Yeah.
Multiple tragic love stories nested. I mean, we didn't even get a chance to talk about the Linda Cardellini stuff, the David Harbour stuff, but I think those were more. I guess that's the one maybe criticism I have is that I don't know why we needed to do like a third variation of a failed heterosexual love with him.
Yeah.
I felt like they used that time to kind of like go and tell the Jake, because that period is that's where we saw Jake stand up to his father-in-law. Like they feel that they use that kind of like period. They like they got to cut back to the main character. So maybe that's what it was. But that's the only thing I found a little bit flabby from a script standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But a great film. Looks great. Sounds great. Performances off the charts. It's a good time. I'm glad we got a chance to see it.
Yeah.
Who knows what prestige this glaring hole in our prestige film library watching will fill next. You'll have to tune in next week to find out because we'll be back with another prestige film. Until that time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you later.